One time when we were in India, traveling around with Swamiji from Yagna to Yagna. Yagna was when he would give like a, sometimes as much as 10 days he would stay in one place, and often there's not halls or anything that are big enough, so he would be out in like in a park, and they'd get one of these tents they'd put up, you know. A lot of people there. Well, this was one little tiny town. I forget the name of it. So there's some kind of a little park, and they had a tent, and maybe there was about 500 or 600 people there, which is a very small group in India. In India, I think. Even when I gave a talk there, when I was just very young, and Swamiji had me teach to some people in the city, and 500 or 600 people came. That was small, you know. It just, you know, there's a small little group in India. But anyway, this is unusually small because the Swamiji, if he's teaching in the city or something, you know, maybe have 5,000, many thousand people. So here there was like, 300 or 400 or 500 at the most people were sitting. And so he came, and he sat up on that little, it's a stage that he had built, and he just did the meditation, and it went on and on. And his mind was just absorbed. He had started talking about something to do with, it was a little after the meditation, he started talking about the pramana and the sampradaya. That's what it was. He started talking about the pramana and the sampradaya. And somehow it moved him. And it absorbed his mind. Yeah. And so he just checked out for the longest time, and we all just sat there, all three or four hundred of us. We sat there and sat there. And he just couldn't come out. So finally he dragged himself out. You know, and then, you know, I think he started talking about the beauty of the whole sampradaya. I don't know what it caused it, but somehow it just totally absorbed him. But I remember it was really a beautiful experience with him, because I realized this, you know, you realize the same things over and over. But I realized that day how sacred that the pramana is, and how sacred it was to him. And I think he was, because that's what he was talking about. He was talking about that sampradaya, you know, that teaching. Sampradaya means the teaching tradition. Because he was so overwhelmed with gratitude that it exists. It's amazing. It's amazing that it exists, that it's there. You know, that we're not just stranded here as jivas with no way out, just bound by ignorance. We don't have a clue what's going on, and there's no way out. If you think of it, that's just such a horrible situation. It's unimaginably horrible situation. If there is no knowledge available, that it's extraordinary to even think about that. But then to think that there is knowledge available, that there is such a thing as self-knowledge, that there is such a thing as liberation of moksha, you know, that actually exists, says something about the nature of the universe, the nature of Ishvara, how beautiful, how benign that exists. And if it didn't exist, it would be the opposite. You know, we all seek to be free, and so we should be able to be free. You know, every human being seeks to be free. Everybody seeks to actually be what they are. And so we should be able to have that. Just imagine if that couldn't, that kind of human longing was just there to not be fulfilled. But in fact, in the Shastra, they even use that as an example, that just like you have eyes, but there's no forms to see. you have ears, but there's no sound. If you eye, you have eyes so you can see, and you have ears because you have things to be heard. You have thirst because there's water, and you have, you know, the need for oxygen, that needing to breathe, there's oxygen to breathe. So there's a relationship there with everything. Every part of you has its counterpart in order to allow that to be, right? To make sense of it, to make it whole. Like eyes with forms, that's complete. You can't have one without the other. That makes it complete, you know. And so say, for you, there's a longing to complete yourself, to be whole, a longing to know who is God, what is going on here, you know, who am I, you know, a longing to be whole and full and complete and be able to say, ah, you know, I've made it now, I've accomplished it. But fulfill yourself. Every human being is kind of on that quest. Even if we look at Jung, how Jung would look at it, just in terms of all of the myths of all of the worlds, all over the world and all of the world religions, it's always a seeking for wholeness or a seeking for union with God or a seeking for completion. Every human being. And say we were not able to fulfill that, that there was no such thing. There was no such fulfillment. And that would be a very incomplete universe. Wouldn't go along with the rest of it. No. But then when you gain knowledge, or even when you realize that it exists, is such an incredible realization. I remember the first time when I was in India. I'd been in India for maybe only 3 months, maybe. And I was up in Rishikesh with Swamiji, where he was teaching. At this time he was teaching. I'd been to two yajnas. Or no, actually I'd only gone a yajna in Ahmedabad, and a little 4-day thing in Bombay, and then a yajna in Ahmedabad. And then I went up to Rishikesh, where he was going to stay for a couple of months and teach the Brahma Sutras and just the sadhus. All the sannyasis would come from all over. That he was up at the foothills of the Himalayas there. And so, after that month or so of exposure, a couple of months of exposure and just absorbing it, you know, I had that realization that there's that it's real, that these words are real, that words like self-knowledge and moksha, liberation, guru, all of these words that I knew of and I was seeking, but I didn't really know if they really existed in a real way that I knew, because I'd experienced it, even though I hadn't completely realized this teaching completely, because I was new to it. I realized it enough to know that it was true and that there was such a thing. There was such a thing as a pramana, a means of knowledge, that existed. You know, that there was such a thing as liberation, that the word, the guru, this whole concept that I'd heard from Yogananda, you know, all these books, that there was such a thing as a guru, that was real. You know, that guru could give you knowledge, could liberate you. All of these words were true. That was an incredible realization. That's prior to really having knowledge. It's just the realization that that's true. And then when you realize, for me, in that realization, of course, then you know that you know. And so then, since you know that, you can just stay with it till it completes itself. There's no doubt, you know. And then you have to wade through all of the all of the problems and all of the stuff, all the pains in your mind and all of that kind of stuff. But doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because you've seen that it exists. And that the whole thing between moksha and liberation and that whole sampradaya is a reality. You know, that's just a huge... huge blessing. I think Swamiji was totally overwhelmed by that. He used to say that because he had lost all of his hair at kind of a young age. He's totally bald completely. He used to say that when he was really seeking and because initially with Swami Chinmayananda, who was his, what we call, Mula Guru, his primary guru, but who didn't really have the capacity to unfold the vision, to give self-knowledge, using it as a pramana. He was very inspirational. But, and would, kind of like Vivekananda, would travel around and inspire people. But he himself didn't wield the pramana. He more or less talked about Vedanta in an inspirational way and sent you off meditating. And so Swamiji meditated and meditated and meditated and did pranayama and pranayama and pranayama. It's a lot. And almost went berserk doing it because even though you can absorb your mind and have experiences, you're still the same old jiva with the experiences in the absorbed mind because no knowledge is there. So say if the Upanishads are taught, this teaching is taught as though it's something, now I'm going to tell you about this, and now you go and realize it. Then there's still a distance between you and what you have to go realize. It's not being handled then as a pramana. And so then you, the seeker, are seeking something. You've been given the directions, and now you have to follow them. And that's not handling it as a pramana. So then what happens is that core jiva, the ajnanam, that core jiva remains, and that jiva tries to become liberated. But that's a problem. Because it's the jiva has to recognize, I am the liberated one. So if the jiva is seeking to become liberated, then there's no liberation of the seeker. Because the jiva is the one who's seeking to become liberated. And so Swamiji was a mumukshu seeking to become liberated. And you know, as he tells the various versions of the story, his are much better. But he was... from a young age, he knew he had studied Sanskrit and learned it in high school and college, so he was very fluent in Sanskrit and had an extraordinary memory, like most many Indians do. And so he had studied, while studying Vedanta, he had studied all of the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita and read everything and had studied all of the books backwards and forwards, knew them all, memorized them. You know, and meditated himself to death. But it wasn't until that cranky old Swami, I've told the story sometimes, this cranky old Swami, who only had 3 lectures up his belt, or the sleeve, as Swamiji would say, Swamiji went to him and heard those 3 lectures. That was Vedanta is a pramana, pramana, pramana. And used it in that way. And then everything clicked into place. Everything. And then when Swamiji went back and read all the commentaries and the bhashas and the Upanishads and everything, yeah, it was all there. It was all there. It's plain as day. And he said it was astounding. He saw it everywhere. But until that, you know, until it was wielded in that way. It was there, but there's a different way of understanding those words. Like, say, for instance, this is a key one that keeps people away from this vision. The word pramana, which means a means of knowledge, is also translated, properly so, as an authority. So say if what you know, if you translate the word pramana as an authority, then the Vedas, the Upanishads, become an authority. It means they're a revealed knowledge and what they say is true. That makes them an authority. They're a valid means of knowledge in the sense of authority. And so you read this, this is the truth, what you read. Now, and go and learn it. That's different than understanding the Vedas or the Upanishads primarily, because the Vedas, when the Vedas are pointing to like the different heaven worlds and Dharma and Adharma, these are not things that you have an immediate recognition of. These are things that you accept as a knowledge, right? So they can be an indirect knowledge. But the Upanishads are a means of knowledge for you to know yourself, not an authority. They're authority in that they're valid, but they're a valid means of knowledge. It means there's a teaching methodology. And so once that methodology is understood, which is passed down from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, but you need to be exposed to a teacher who uses it as a pramana. So when that pramana is understood, right, then the whole way of listening, the whole way of seeing the Vedas, everything becomes alive as a means of knowledge for you to understand, you see immediately, directly who you are now. And then you go meditate on what you've seen. You meditate on what you know. You don't meditate to know, you meditate on what you do know. That's a huge difference, because otherwise we're seeking to know through meditation. So we're looking, like I'm looking with my eyes to see something. I'm in meditation, I'm looking with my mind to experience something. Looking just internally, bringing the mind into a certain condition, more and more into that condition in order for it to gain an experience. That's a whole different way of relating. This is Nididhyasana, is more allowing my mind to be with myself, to come into relationship with myself, the self I recognize at the time of teaching. So it's a whole, totally, totally different. That's why they make such a huge Shankara in all of his Prakarana Granthas, whether it's an Atma Bodha or it doesn't matter what the text is, all of them. The distinction between karma and knowledge. Karma means action. I do this in order to gain something. Liberation is not karma. You can't do anything to gain yourself. Anything. You can do things to get a healthier body. You can do things to help calm your mind. You can do things, but there's nothing you can do to gain yourself, and there's nothing you can do to become free. You can't make this body infinite or timeless. This body's going to draw and die. You can't make your mind be exactly what you want it to be. It's got a life of its own. Now, it's all limited just by nature. It's limited by nature. You can't make it. You can't free it from what it is. Let's put it that way. You can't free the upadis from what they are. You can improve them and shine them up and all of that. But you cannot free them from their own nature. And you can't free yourself from your own nature either. There's nothing you can do about yourself either. But the problem is, yourself is fine. There's nothing needs to be done. But if there was something, there's nothing you can do either. You can't free yourself from your nature. And so it's not a problem here of doing, and it's certainly not a problem of reaching, because you already are yourself. So you can't reach yourself. And if you're limited by nature, there's nothing you could do about that either. And if you're limitless by nature, there's nothing you can do about that either. So it's a question of removing the ignorance that causes yourself to be conflated or superimposed on all of these things that are limited. It's not a problem of reaching. And it's not a problem of experiencing yourself differently either. You can't experience yourself differently. The experience that you have of yourself right now is the experience that you'll have of yourself when you're liberated. You know? It's not like all of a sudden you're going to get a different experience of yourself. It'll be exactly the same. And it's not going to become more present either. You'll just realize that, oh, it was present all along. I've been present all along. In full measure. It's just that I thought I was my mind. I thought that what I was most attached to was my mind. And then my mind was trying to find myself. But actually that which I am most attached to is the self. Which is the very being and substance of the mind. So that has to be recognized. And then the mind is fine. It's happy. Because I am what I seek, that's why. And the mind knows, without any doubt, that I am what I seek, then it can relax. Now, that this knowledge exists is what makes the universe a compassionate universe. That makes Ishwar compassionate. And that's a nice kind of nice meditation. Because there's that means that this knowledge is, you're not left high and dry, like a rock or something, you know. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamandaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Yeah. Sometimes I have problems with words, you know, because I've taught English myself, you know, when I came from Europe. And the word knowledge, I don't know why it's such a block, but I think knowledge means being informed of that which you don't know.
Oh, that's good. There's, I understand the question. It's a good question. It depends on how you're using the word. Like, if we can use knowledge as synonymous to awareness, then it's something that knowledge that illumines everything. Or you can use it as knowledge as something that needs to be gained. And so here the mind needs to gain knowledge, but the knowledge it's gaining is really the removal of ignorance. And that's because the nature of yourself is already present. It's already self-shining. It's already known as an experientially just as consciousness. And so you are already are known to yourself experientially, your very being, self-lit, so to speak. But the problem is not the self-experience. That's there, fine for everybody, as your own being. But the mind takes that self to be itself. And so it needs to gain knowledge, right? That it needs to have that ignorance removed, so that it can recognize that the self is independent of it. It's totally dependent on the self for its consciousness and for its being. But the self is not dependent on it at all. And so that means that ignorance is in its way. Because without that knowledge, then it takes itself to be limited.
So this is why it's not about gaining something. Because that's what we have been doing. That's what the ignorance is.
Right.
You know, gaining more sophistication to live in the world, gaining a job.
That's right.
So that's the ignorance, huh?
Yeah. And also, even in terms of knowledge, we're gaining knowledge of things that are away from us, like knowledge of that painting, knowledge of Sanskrit, knowledge of things that are away from me. Even though that's not an action, I need my sense organs or my pramanas to gain that knowledge. Still, that knowledge that's being gained is not me. Here, the subject of the knowledge is myself, and myself is not away from the mind. Right? And so there's no distance. There's no where for the mind to go. So the mind just, now it's a question not of gaining a knowledge of me as though I'm away from the mind. Rather, it's the mind, the ignorance being removed from the mind that causes it to think, I am the self. Do you see what I mean? There's no distance between the self and the one who needs to know the self. Like there's a distance between the mind and that painting. There's no distance between the mind and me. In fact, I'm the one that lights up the mind. I'm the very consciousness that lights up the mind. And so now this mind has to recognize through teaching, through the use of a pramana, that the mind is known, and the self is the very consciousness that allows it to be known. The self is changeless. The mind is changing. It needs to recognize that. So that's the removal of self-ignorance. Right, so it's a little different then. And once that ignorance is removed, the self never goes away. Whereas if I'm having a direct, through my sense, through my eyes, I'm having a direct perception of this painting. So now I have direct immediate knowledge of the painting because I'm looking at it. But if I go like this, that's gone. Now I have a memory of that perception. You see what I mean? Well, with the self never goes. It doesn't matter what the thought is, what the perception is. The self that I've gained knowledge of is always the one present. It never goes away. So it's not dependent upon vrittis, or memory. See, like, if I look at this painting, I have direct knowledge, immediate knowledge of the painting. If I look like this, now for me to have knowledge of that painting, I have to remember it. Right? I have to bring it back into memory. You see that? Okay, now, with myself, here myself is, the awareness, the me, is illumining the mind. Okay? My mind is ignorant of that, so it takes the self to be the mind, right? Now the mind gains knowledge, which means that ignorance is removed, so that now it recognizes that me, the me, right, that illumines the mind and is present to the mind, is independent, asanga, unattached, not attached to the mind. It has its own being. And so now this being, me, is there changelessly present, no matter what the thought is. And now there's another thought, now there's another thought, now there's another thought. But What remains is the me that I've recognized as independent from the mind. So that knowledge now that has removed the ignorance, it's done its job. It's removed the ignorance. And so I am now shining independently as I am, without the ignorance of the mind that causes it to take itself, the self as the mind. And so no matter what I think, what I feel, what I see, what I do, from the standpoint of the mind or the body, that ignorance has been removed, so the one who is always present to all of that remains as me. And I don't have to remember myself, because I'm already here. But there's no one to remember, because there's nobody that's left. If I go like this, now I have to remember the pain. What if I have a really bad memory? But here I'm looking at it, but if I go, now, what was that? What did that look like? I have to be able to recall it. See? I don't need to recall myself because I haven't gone. It's just that I keep looking at the painting, I don't have to recall it. Yeah.
But the mind doesn't go either. It's just always changing, huh?
Or in deep sleep.
Right.
So as long as you're a human being with a supadhi, the mind will be there or in different conditions.
When we talk about, everyone talks about mind, body, and spirit, and it's kind of weird because it's...
Well, when you say mind, body, and spirit, most people don't know what the spirit, and they don't know what those words mean.
Yeah.
Right. But we have a body and we have a mind, and then there's a spirit, whatever. Well, I don't know, because I don't use those terms. But if you ask the people who use the terms, like if I were to use the terms, I would say the body is the body, the mind is the antakarana that has the four basic types of thoughts, and I would say that the spirit, depending on who's talking, I would say, well, the spirit is either Brahman. I would probably say the spirit is Brahman. If I were trying to squeeze the Vedanta into those words, spirit would be the Atma, which is Brahman. The mind would be the Sukshma Sharira, really, the different functions of the mind, and the body would be the body. And then there's a differentiation: mind, body, spirit, and then soul.
Because it is used in the Tao,
Oh yeah.
And the Tao is.
But you have to, you say that, and if it, you have to see how the Tao uses those words. Those are translations. So what are they translations of? That's what you have to see. Because you can read a Vedanta text and they use mind, body, and maybe they translate Brahman as spirit or something. That would be awful, but I don't think. But say they use spirit. To me, that word means nothing until the teacher teaches me what it means. Right. Or soul, or anywhere. The teacher has to, who knows who's a master in that, has to, since they're using an English word, now they have to fill that English word with a proper meaning. Because otherwise, somebody goes and just says, well, in the Tao, they use mind, body, spirit, as though that means the same thing as when somebody else is using it. So, I mean, that's the same problem in Vedanta and in Buddhism and all of the things. They use English language, which is fine. It just has to be taught. Words.
For me, it seemed like the process of realization, self-realization, seems to be the more organic, kind of intrinsic sort of word. Because when I think of knowledge, I think more of an after-the-fact sort of thing. An after-the-fact, one step removed from the actual experience itself. So it's like the realization for me is more intrinsically.
Yeah, because you're realizing yourself, yeah.
Yeah, it's more intrinsically transformative.
Yeah, I can see that too. But even then, I would go to say the same thing, that if you use realization, I use a lot of different words, but whatever word that you use, you have to unpack the word so that it means what it means to you, it means for you, the student, whoever you're talking to. I think with Vedanta, with the whole teaching methodology, so much of it has to do with making each word be seen. So So no word is taken for granted. You know, and then the word, that word is then united with another word. Like the whole Mahavakya, that thou art. You are that. So much knowledge has to go into unfolding what you means. Right? And what that means is Ishwara. Otherwise, it, you know, and what do we mean by identity? What do we mean you are that? That's what these next verses that in the Viveka Chidamani talk about.
But you know what I find strange about it is that, like, you know, I've studied a lot of stuff before I came here, you know, and thou art that, you know, I am that, this is that, all of this is that, you know, thou art that. But I actually believe that I got it. Do you know what I mean? So, but that's why I keep saying, intuitively, feeling-wise, I got it. But I'm not sure if that's true. Because that's like, you know, trying to interpret spirit, you know.
Well, I remember when I was about 18 or so, or 19, I had this kind of poignant moment, revelatory moment that said in great big letters in my mind, all are one. And I knew it was true. I knew it was the truth. That it had all. It, I just knew it, that it was the truth. But I couldn't tell you what it meant on any type of level except realizing that it's true. But to talk about that means me, that I am non-dual, what I know these words all to mean now, I didn't have any words or any enlightenment at all. I just, you know, and I think we've all had that experience, like sometimes you'll be reading a book, you have no knowledge at all, but there'll be, maybe you'll read that thou art in a book or something, you know, that just, you know that it's true, but there's nothing more you can say about that.
It's abstract, huh?
It's an abstract, but it goes deep into some intuitive understanding.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated.
Who knows?